We wanna smash, crash, pass, smash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Dr. Nolan Higdon, lecturer in media studies and history, and co-author with me of United States of Distraction, a book out on City Lights from last year. We're going to discuss the struggle inside the Democratic Party between neoliberals and progressives, as well as how the neoliberal policies have helped shape U.S. response to coronavirus. Of course, we'll analyze corporate media coverage of all this as well. Then, a couple weeks ago, I had the opportunity to catch up with interdisciplinary scholar and Project Censored contributor Emil Marmel about how the Democratic and neoliberal establishment have resurrected the canard of a third Red Scare and Russiagate. We hope you enjoy our conversations. Stay with us.
Stakes are tied, unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of today's program, we're going, of course, to be analyzing corporate media coverage of key events of our day. One, of course, will be the response to COVID-19 and the coronavirus. We'll also talk about conflicts within the Democratic Party and the DNC. We welcome back to the program for this segment for analysis, lecturer of history and media studies, Dr. Nolan Higdon. Nolan Higdon, of course, is also a longtime contributor to Project Censored. He's co-host of the Along the Line podcast, which can be heard via the projectcensored.org website. Nolan Higdon is also co-author of United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America and What We Can Do About It, a book that we co-authored together for City Lights Books. And Nolan is also finishing another book on the anatomy of fake news that'll be out this June on University of California. We've also been writing a series of op-eds and articles about media coverage of various things from the primaries to COVID-19. And that's why we have you on the show today. So, Nolan Higdon, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Nolan, we are now seeing in the midst of the coronavirus and COVID-19 that the United States was clearly underprepared, that President Donald Trump, to say he dropped the ball on this would be an understatement, from saying it's a hoax to downplaying it to attacking the news media about it. But in an article that'll be published here really soon, we've argued that we shouldn't just blame Trump for what's happening with COVID-19 because the U.S. has been becoming a failed state for some time. And as you and I begin the prologue of our United States of Distraction book, we have a very apt quote from Lao Tzu. It says, "If you do not change direction, you may end up where you are heading." Well, Nolan Higdon, where have we been heading for some half a century with neoliberal policies?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how someone won't bat an eye to blame a particular political party or politician for where we're at. Rarely do voters look in the mirror. At some level, the COVID-19 crisis is a coming to fruition or coming to a head of our anti-science, our anti-intellectualism, our treatment of democracy as entertainment and spectacle. All these things have come together in a very toxic way. The discourse around COVID-19 right now is nobody could have saw this coming. Although there were plenty of experts who saw this coming, who made warnings. In fact, the scandal around Senator Richard Burr did in fact reach the higher echelons of our government. Our government was more interested in playing politics. They told the people that it was fine, we have it under control. While privately, they were selling off stock and warning lobbyists and other internationally invested folks. This has always been an odd thing of my lifetime, as people consistently in the United States believe government shouldn't do anything, and they vote for people who say government can't do anything. And then Americans are shocked when government doesn't work, when it can't protect them on 9/11, when it can't protect them from the financial collapse, or when it can't protect them from COVID-19. In essence, this is what you voted for. You wanted a government that can't do anything. Well, you got one that's not doing anything.
Yeah, and there is certainly, while we don't wish harm upon anyone, great irony in the recent reports of Rand Paul being the first person in the Senate to test positive for COVID-19. You know, of course, Rand Paul, son of Ron Paul, the more libertarian-leaning figure, Rand seemingly named after Ayn Rand. So the whole idea there is that, well, government shouldn't be involved, government shouldn't be providing things like health care to people and so forth. Yet Rand Paul enjoys some of the best health care in the world. that millions of Americans don't have access to, and we can't even get enough tests to test people who show symptoms.
Yeah, and let me echo what you're saying there. I mean, Rand Paul and me could not be more ideologically apart, but I do respect the guy that he has a set of principles and he stands up to them. So I don't wish him any sort of harm or think he's a bad person. But being against government is really easy, because when government does its job poorly, it's really easy to point out. But when government does its job well, you don't hear about it because it does its job well. When it stops a catastrophe, when it prevents a crisis from occurring, there's not much news coverage around it. So to be a backer of government or public services, you don't get a lot of time to celebrate and cheerlead. But when these institutions fail, it's very easy to point out the major crises that they cause.
Indeed. And so let's look, too, though, at some of this controlled demolition, so to speak, right? This whole idea that the market will provide health care, the market will provide people with the types of services that they need to live decent lives. That's all blowing up in everyone's faces here in the past couple of weeks. And of course, we'll talk about this later, the primaries. But where have you seen any sense of leadership coming at a time like this? I'm thinking maybe we're seeing it at a local or state level. But where are you seeing people step up to the plate, perhaps, about this issue? People that might show us how government could run or how it could respond to these types of issues.
You're seeing nonprofit organizations and cities and states try and take whatever action they can. In this sense, in the economic terms, that's much like the Great Depression, where we exhausted all these nonprofit cities, states, county governments, and that's what caused it to become a bigger crisis. But as far as bigger ideas of how to fix our society in general, it was interesting in the Democratic primary, you had ideas of Medicare for all and a universal basic income, which were sort of laughed at by the establishment and the news media. But fast forward, here we are in the midst of COVID, and all of a sudden there's a discussion of how can we get medical care to people? Should we be giving people a basic income to keep the economy afloat? These are the very same things Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang were just talking about that were just laughed at. And yet you still have a big portion of Washington, and quite frankly, it's the Democratic Party, trying to push for these incremental economic changes to address COVID-19. I mean, at some level, the Republicans have been more aggressive and more left than the Democrats. If you'll recall, the Republicans were talking about a multi-billion dollar, even trillion dollar stimulus package, while the Democrats were still arguing about means testing. I mean, an old Republican talking point from the 80s. So it's been, as far as parties go, it's been sort of all over the place. You haven't seen much leadership in any kind of quantifiable way.
It's pretty alarming. And where we have seen some of that leadership or those ideas, it's just been shifted outside the margins of any media attention. While they might simultaneously start batting around ideas of universal basic income and healthcare and these kind of things, it's completely divorced from Yang or Sanders or progressive movements.
Things like universal healthcare or universal basic income, those are things you don't need until you need them. So they'll always seem like a quote-unquote waste of money when no one's using them, but you have them available for when they're needed. Like right now, there are millions of people who wish they had those things.
All of this is happening right before our eyes, and certainly at a time in a crisis where we need accurate information the most, a lot of people still have to turn to corporate media, which of course is just addled with various conflicts and biases and so forth. And we have a current administration and a president who not long ago just literally attacked a reporter, NBC reporter, who asked an incredibly softball question of any leader, how to quell the fears of the American public. And Trump just completely turned on him and said, "You're a terrible reporter," which just continues Trump's authoritarian road where he sees the press as the enemy of the people. Nolan?
It's tough to choose a side. On the one hand, Trump is just this belligerent fearmonger who's attacking anyone who's trying to tell or protect the truth, i.e. members of the press. But on the other hand, the press have put themselves in this position where people don't trust or respect them with these ginormous failures like their coverage of the Iraq War, their coverage of the financial collapse, their coverage of the 2016 election, their coverage of Russiagate. They've lost a lot of credibility in that profession. So you're watching on the sideline. Now, if you guys had established credibility in the past, maybe I'd feel a little more empathetic to you in the press, but it's tough.
Yeah, this is definitely a challenging time and certainly an opportunity for a lot in the independent and alternative media to shine the very kind of sources that we promote at Project Censored and, of course, the very kind of things that we teach in terms of critical media literacy in our classroom with our students. I'd like to remind Listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Nolan Higdon. Right now, we're talking about media coverage of coronavirus and COVID-19. And one of the other things we've talked about and we've addressed is in this current crisis, you've talked about Tom Nichols describing the death of expertise. Can you talk about that concept and how that's also factoring into some of the challenges we face here in terms of a relatively scientifically illiterate public?
To echo what I was saying earlier about how sometimes you don't think you need services like healthcare or universal basic income until you do, the same thing goes for experts. You don't think you need an expert until you need one. So everyone hates experts until they need one. But experts come in obviously various professions, and they're the ones who give us insight about not only why something happened, but what to do afterward. Unfortunately, though, we really marginalize experts. And I think this comes, and Tom Nichols talks about this in his book, The Death of Expertise. This comes from this internet age where we encourage everyone to evaluate and review everyone. And in that, people have started to believe they are quote-unquote experts. If they need an answer to something, they can Google it. If they don't like something, they can share their opinion. But just because you have an opinion doesn't mean it's valid or well-supported. So a lot of times, like when people are reviewing their doctors, it's not really clear what they're reviewing as a patient. You're not trained in the medical field. What exactly are you reviewing? I know as a professional educator, I can speak to this. Getting reviewed by non-educators about what education looks like. Who are these people? You're not an expert in this field, but the internet age has given people the power to feel empowered, like they are equal to these experts and can evaluate them. Well, right now we need real experts, you know, people to talk about global health policy, big thinkers who need to have deep knowledge. It's very expansive and be well-connected in deep discourses. This is not a time to appeal to politics or surface-level Google searches. There's a much deeper conversation needed that very few experts have. And I think, you know, unfortunately, we live in a world that doesn't respect those people. And that might be why this got out of control in the first place. You know, weeks before the first case in the United States, experts were warning about this going to happen on our soil, and we just ignored it.
You know, this reminds me, too, of the terminology that we've been playing around with for the last few years now about a post-truth world. And as Lee McIntyre writes in his book, post-truth amounts to a form of ideological supremacy whereby its practitioners are trying to compel someone to believe in something, whether there is good evidence for it or not.
We need experts at this point in time. We need very clear answers. We don't need politics and sort of trivial opinion.
No, and this selective use of facts that prop up one's position and the complete rejection of facts that, you know, don't seems part and parcel of creating a post-truth reality where we can summon alternative facts, cherry-pick facts. That really turns out to be one of our bigger challenges and bigger enemies.
That level of discourse where all you do is cherry-pick so you can quote-unquote be right is just self-serving. It's not producing knowledge. It's not helping anything. What we need right now is we need answers. We need productive knowledge. We need action, not making people feel like they're correct.
And we certainly need critical thinking, I would say now. I wouldn't say now more than ever, perhaps. I think we've always needed it. But I think as we've entered more and more into this media-saturated, hyper-partisan landscape, as you and I write about in The United States of Distraction, our book from City Lights, it seems as though if we do not change direction, we will end up where we're heading, back to Lao Tzu. And we always ask in our talks, are we there yet? It seems like the there where we are arriving upon is quite disastrous. It's not like we just ended up here yesterday. These are the consequences of what happens when we adopt neoliberal policies to the profit of corporations and private companies and at the expense of the public. I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm speaking with Dr. Nolan Higdon. He's a lecturer in history and media studies at California State University, East Bay. Also teaches at several other schools in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's co-author of United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. And he's also author of numerous op-ed pieces on Counterpunch and Truth Out and ProjectCensored.org that we've written together. And also host of the Along the Line podcast. After this brief musical break, we're going to return with Nolan Higdon, and we're going to turn our discussion into the internal struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party between neoliberals and progressives. Stay with us. Our so-called leaders speak with words they try to jail you. They subjugate the meek. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program today, we welcome back Dr. Nolan Higdon, lecturer in history and media studies at Cal State University, East Bay, co-author of United States, a Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Nolan Higdon, before the break, we were talking about media coverage, neoliberalism, and COVID-19, and right now, another op-ed that we've been working on, a topic that's certainly been on our minds and one that we wrote about at Truthout not too long ago, the Democratic Party's last gasp of neoliberalism. Let's talk about what you think is happening inside the Democratic Party between neoliberals and progressives, and then let's talk about what some possible solutions might be. Nolan?
We talk about this a lot in our book, and it's a distraction, but neoliberals essentially hijacked the party in the 1970s and used their money to push out any progressive candidates. That's why there's this huge age gap of progressives in the Democratic Party between Bernie Sanders, who's in his 70s, and Ocasio-Cortez, who's in her 30s. There's nothing really in between because those people have been pushed out. But neoliberalism was never really popular amongst the electorate. When Democrats adopted it, since they've adopted it, voter turnout has increasingly gone down, the one exception being 1992, but that spike in voter turnout was only because of the addition of Ross Perot as a third-party candidate. And the Democrats ironically claimed, look, we have to run more centrist and less progressive to win elections. However, they had controlled Congress from the 40s until the 90s. Once they've adopted neoliberalism, they've almost lost control of the Congress. They've lost control of 1,000 seats under Obama. And like I said, less people turn out. So since 2008, they depended on not only centrists and neoliberals, but the youth. Obama created this new coalition. But the youth quickly got pretty upset with the Democrats, and they rallied around Bernie Sanders' policy agenda. And the Democrats have done everything they can to marginalize Sanders, which looks like it's going to deliver a Biden victory in the primary. But if you're a Democrat, you should be quite worried. And some, you know, even corporate news is now reporting on this. Biden cannot reach the youth vote. And there's a big fear that he's going to get smashed by Trump. So this civil war is often painted between progressives and neoliberals. But underneath that, it's most expressed generationally. It's really a war between this older generation and younger generation of the Democratic Party. And if either of them want to defeat Trump, they need each other. And it doesn't seem they can find any sort of consensus around either of these candidates or even policy.
The electoral strategy here that the DNC has put forward, it's been pretty clear that they've favored very pro-corporate, neoliberal candidates, Wall Street-friendly candidates. Of course, Biden, in particular, Joe Biden, who's been AWOL here of late with the COVID-19 crisis, where Bernie Sanders has taken to the public with all kinds of proposals, New Deal-like proposals to mitigate the effects of this on the population. Explain to our listeners, why is it that Joe Biden has the nickname the Senator from MasterCard? What is it about his policies that might be turning off young progressives?
Initially, when Joe Biden announced he was going to run, I think a lot of young people, they only remembered Biden from the Obama administration. That's why I said he'll have Obama dust on him, but it'll disappear once people look into his record. Here's a guy who tried to cut Social Security 4 times. He's a guy that really screwed over the poor and working class by getting rid of access to bankruptcy protections for people so you effectively can never get out of debt. This is a guy who passed the racist crime bill in 1994. He's a guy who voted for NAFTA. He voted for putting the social safety net on the table to cut that. So he's really been the direct opposite of what progressives want. And so I think you have a younger generation, the millennials, which are the biggest part of the voting block in 2020, who just have a distaste for Biden. And it doesn't look like they're going to turn out. And I think it's important to note that, again, since the 70s, we've only had two Democratic presidents. One, Bill Clinton, who won as a result of Ross Perot running as a third-party candidate. And then second was Barack Obama, who turned out the youth in massive numbers, numbers that still have not been matched in 2012, 2016, or it appears 2020. So Biden doesn't really have a winning strategy, yet the party rallied behind him and sold the American public on this idea that he's the most electable. He's electability, a term they never define. But it's not really clear what they mean by electability. I don't know where the evidence is for that, but if you look at the polls for people, they continue to believe that Biden is the most electable candidate, and we believe that it's the media that has primed audiences to believe that Biden is electable. There's no real evidence to say that Biden is electable.
To add to your laundry list, Bill Clinton moved the party further to the right in that election. He won with about 42% of the vote, which is basically about what Woodrow Wilson won in 1912 with a three-way split. Except in that election, there were two alleged progressives against an establishment conservative. But nevertheless, Clinton said that why do we give up the Wall Street parties to the Republicans, right? And then it's Clinton that helped repeal Glass-Steagall with Joe Biden's vote. Also, the Telecommunications Act that paved the way for a myopic group of half a dozen corporations to own the media. Biden supported that. Biden supported the Defense of Marriage Act. Biden supported Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Biden attacked Anita Hill and Monica Lewinsky. On and on and on. None of these kind of stances resonate with A, traditionally liberal people like FDR types, or certainly not 21st century progressives. How is the public being led to believe that somehow Biden is a candidate of the people or of the public when the public clearly says they support policies that Biden doesn't?
Add one other thing to that. The Democrats, they've long realized they can't win on policy because the policy they want to send, that laundry list you just gave, the policy they want to enact, it isn't popular with the people. So they've had to go with an agenda that is, let's just beat the Republicans. Let's just beat the Republicans. So we're better than the Republicans. And that's the message they're hoping that is going to turn people out. And so they're trying to hope that people will believe that Biden is better than Trump. And as a result, that'll be enough to turn people out to support Joe Biden. But given that record you just read, I don't see how it's possible. Now, this is kind of the funny part in media. Sanders was attacked, this dates back to 2016. Look, man, if you start going after these candidates, you're simply helping Trump. So any attack Bernie made on the establishment candidates was conflated with helping Trump. So you really didn't attack Biden's record. The media, for its part, particularly the 24-hour news networks of MSNBC and CNN, they never really raised questions about Biden's record on all the things you just listed. So Trump is not going to give that kind of leeway to Biden. All this stuff that's been sitting there is now going to come out in the general election. I think it's going to cook Joe Biden horribly. The Democrats, you know, their game plan seemed to be is let's just not criticize him. Let's claim he's electable. You had folks like Chris Matthews, Anderson Cooper, David Axelrod, Terry McAuliffe. You had all these folks on these 24-hour news networks making the case for Biden without any real questions or criticisms of him. Now Biden's going to be in the general, and I think he's just going to be torn down by Trump. You look at this 40-year record. One thing that came out of 2016, and I think it continues in 2020, is that the majority of the electorate is very upset with the way things are. You'd be hard-pressed to find someone more than Joe Biden who's a symbol of creating things the way they are. He's consistently voted in favor of the policy that people reject. In some ways, he's more unlikable than Hillary Clinton in that. Hillary Clinton's legislative record went back to 2001, and Biden's goes back to the 70s. So I think that the Democratic Party desperately wanted to defeat that progressive wing. They assumed, as they always do, that progressives will not have a better choice and will automatically turn out for the Democrats, especially in the wake of Trump. But they're really gambling here. In 2016, a lot of progressives and young people did not turn out for Hillary Clinton. Many of them stayed home. And my fear is that's going to happen again. And, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of exciting. This might lead to an end of the Democratic Party and raise an opportunity for a labor working class party. But in the short term, four more years of a Trump administration, I don't think is anything any of us are really excited for.
And of course, Trump runs on a pretty much purely propagandistic emotional campaign when appealing to many of his supporters. Of course, his policies have also supported large swaths of Wall Street, the corporate establishment, not across the board, but certainly more so than many suspected, with people claiming that Trump was a populist billionaire candidate. So it seems like we're poised for another neoliberal pseudo showdown here in November, Nolan. What are your thoughts on this?
I completely agree. And I think it's something interesting for our listeners to consider. And Bernie Sanders is really guilty of this as well. The Republicans call themselves the Grand Old Party, and they try and base themselves in history. And they often make this claim, you know, we're the party of Lincoln, as if 150 plus years have not gone by. But the Democrats do something similar. I mean, they ground themselves in like this progressive history of the LBJ, Great Society, and New Deal. You know, that was really only the party from the 1930s to the 70s. Pre-1930s, they were the white supremacist South Party. And post-1970s, they've been the rich, college-educated, suburban elite party. So this appeals to the Democrats as being for working-class people and a multiracial party of inclusivity. A lot of it's based on symbols. It's not really based on policy or action or anything like that. So I think Democratic voters really need to look themselves in the mirror and ask, do I keep fighting for this party because I want it to be something it kind of was decades ago? Or do I want to develop something different that actually serves the needs of myself and the people I care about?
Is selectively reaching back into history, the Democratic Party establishment and corporate media have resurrected a neo-McCarthyism based on the heels of Russiagate. We've got this third Red Scare, which has really been used as an establishment antidote to 21st century populism and progressivism.
We all know Trump's populist message was intellectually bankrupt and had no policy to back it. But you can't deny that it was popular. It appealed to voters. But Democrats chose to deny that, and they had to make up some argument of why Trump won. And they've largely depended upon this McCarthyite explanation that Russia was behind the election. And so they weaponized this for years, and it primed the liberal public to believe that Russia's behind everything that's bad. And simply, after it ran its course being used against Trump, they turned it against Bernie Sanders and progressives now. And it's this weaponized notion that's being done to silence any sort of progressive populist challenge to the Democratic Party establishment. It's intellectually bankrupt, but it's also shocking at how pervasive it is. I'm amazed at how commentators just in passing speech will say that, oh, Putin is for Sanders without any evidence. This raises the level of acceptable discourse, which is very sad.
Indeed it is. And again, we have a piece coming out about this. It might be out by the time the show airs. People can go to projectcensored.org to learn more, or of course follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, where we link all of the pieces that we write wherever they're published. And again, I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Nolan Higdon. He's lecturer in media studies and history at Cal State University, East Bay. He's also co-host of the Along the Line podcast. If you haven't heard it, please tune into that. You can learn more about that also at projectcensored.org. And Nolan's also co-author with me of The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Nolan Higdon, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to share your thoughts with us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
Up next, we talk to Emil Marmol about the third Red Scare. Stay with us.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program today, we welcome back Emil Marmol. Emil is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, Ontario, Institute for Studies in Education. He's an interdisciplinary scholar with experience in professional film and radio production. Emil has published on critical media literacy, Cuban society, the impact of neoliberalism on higher education, and many, many more things. There's a long list of them. And in fact, Emil is currently finishing his doctoral thesis. Some of our listeners here at the Project Censored Show, though, I hope, remember Emil Marmol because we had him on last year about a chapter that he co-wrote with Lee Major. It's called Fake News, the Trojan Horse for Silencing Alternative News and Reestablishing Corporate News Dominance. Well, today, we welcome Emil back to the program in the throes of the Democratic primary in the 2020 presidential election because the Russians are coming, or at least the Russians never went away. Emil is working on a piece now that will be up at Project Censored's site about how Russia and Russiagate has managed to worm its way into the Bernie Sanders media coverage of the campaign. We've seen a lot of media pundits and talking heads bringing Russiagate back in. This isn't just recently, but going back last year and earlier this year with Hillary Clinton talking about Russians and Tulsi Gabbard. Russians are everywhere. But Emil Marmol, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you very much for having me back. It's a real pleasure.
Let's jump right in here about what's happening around this kind of propaganda effort. After the 2016 election, we remember that Russia allegedly interfered in the election and tipped the balances to Donald Trump. We've talked about this repeatedly on the program and how there's actually very little evidence that actually would even suggest that that was something that was a real thing that happened. Yes, Russia tried to interfere. No, it didn't tip the outcome of the election. But more importantly, what we're seeing here is more like a redux of neo-McCarthyism and Cold War propaganda. Could you update our listeners about some of the more recent iterations here, why we should be worried about the Russians or not?
If listeners want to really get a good grasp of just how out of proportion and misled they are on Russiagate, they should read the chapter or listen to the previous show that you mentioned. But now Russiagate continues to pay dividends, and it's being used against Bernie Sanders to slander him, to sully his reputation. There are many who saw this coming. Back in July of 2017, Max Blumenthal of The Gray Zone said the following, quote, "This Russia hysteria will be repurposed by the political establishment to attack the left and anyone on the left, a Bernie Sanders-like politician who steps out of line on the issues of permanent war or corporate free trade, things like that, will be painted as Russia puppets. So this is very dangerous, and people who are progressive, who are falling into it, need to know what the long-term consequences of this cynical narrative are." And he was right. There has been an absolute corporate media frenzy about how the Russians are purportedly helping Sanders. And if you don't mind, I'd like to offer you a sampling. I've got quite a few.
Yeah, actually, that would be great for listeners, because I know that a lot of folks that call themselves progressives, liberals, etc., some of those folks, of course, do listen to the Project Censored show. And this has been a real divisive topic for a lot of people, liberals, progressives, and others on the left about this Russian canard. So, Emil Marmol, I think it would be very useful for you to go through the details here of things that we've just seen in 2020.
Really, there's been a frenzy. There's a ton of articles and newscasts and whatnot. We don't have the time to get into all of them, but here's some highlights. So there was a Washington Post article that ran on February 21st, the day before the Nevada caucus, that was titled, quote, "Bernie Sanders briefed by U.S. officials that Russia is trying to help his presidential campaign," end quote. The article admits that it is not clear what form that Russian assistance has taken. And this article provides no evidence whatsoever. Then you have Democratic strategist James Carville. He said of the Nevada results as they were being released that, quote, "They were going very well for Vladimir Putin." And then, you know, we were told by commentators on CNN's State of the Union that the real winner in Nevada was Putin and that Russia will benefit if Bernie is the nominee. The New York Times has run several articles on Russian election interference. Some examples are on February 20th, an article titled "Lawmakers are warned that Russia is meddling to reelect Trump." In this one, Republican Representative Chris Stewart asserts, quote, "I challenge anyone to give me a real-world argument where Putin would rather have President Trump and not Bernie Sanders." Now, there's a reference made to Mueller's report about the Russians desiring to, quote, "help Mr. Sanders in his presidential primary against Hillary Clinton in 2016. There's another article from February 21st that is much more explicit in aim. It's titled, "Russia is said to be interfering to aid Sanders in Democratic primaries." The article mentions officials who argue that, quote, "a Russian campaign to support Mr. Sanders might ultimately be aimed at aiding Mr. Trump. Moscow could potentially consider Mr. Sanders a weaker general election opponent." However, as with all other articles that I'm going to mention, there's no evidence. There's no evidence of this anywhere. No news source has provided evidence. It's all hearsay.
There have even been claims that were made that had to be retracted by intelligence people and so forth. This is like a trial balloon, right? They just keep bringing it out. Rachel Maddow basically has made a cottage industry out of Russiagate.
Oh.
And so this is the gift that keeps on giving for the establishment to tarnish people that are more on the progressive or left end of the Democratic Party. But at any rate, Emil, continue, because I'm afraid you have far more examples.
I do. And Rachel Maddow is at the vanguard of the Russiagate lie. She's doing such a disservice to the American public. But going back to this last article that I was mentioning, in that article, it's admitted that, quote, "Russia's interference measures and their intensity remain murky, even as intelligence officials sound alarms." I would say it's not murky. It's simply non-existent. On February 21st, they published another article titled, "Trump dismisses warning of Russian 2020 meddling as Democratic hoax." The article states, intelligence officials have also concluded that the Russians are seeking to help Senator Sanders of Vermont in the Democratic presidential primaries. Again, there's no evidence provided. And then the final one from the New York Times I want to talk about is, on February 22nd, they published an article titled, Same Goal, Different Playbook, Why Russia Would Support Trump and Sanders. The article argues that Russia's fine with either Trump or Sanders as president because, quote, neither is very likely to pursue policies that push back aggressively on Mr. Putin's plan to restore Moscow's influence around the world. Now, that's bananas. You know why? Because it's indicating that Trump hasn't been hard enough on Russia. And the message I'm getting is, do you actually want him to push the nuclear button? Because that's how close we are to nuclear annihilation. So I don't know what this person is meaning to say when they say that Trump isn't hard on Russia. Trump has been incredibly hard on Russia.
We're closer than 2 minutes to midnight as far as the nuke clock has gone. But at any rate, this kind of article, what is this, some kind of bump for a neoliberal candidate like a Joe Biden?
Exactly.
Given that Elizabeth Warren is out of the race. Yeah, this is pretty interesting. But continue.
What I like about this article is it does caution, quote, that such reports are as much art as science, a mixture of informants, intercepted conversations, and intuition as analysis in the nation's 17 intelligence agencies try to get into the heads of foreign leaders. I mean, I love that because wow. You know what it sounds like to me? Astrology hocus pocus.
It sounds like Nancy Reagan.
Reagans were good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, at any rate, I wish this was the end of your list, but you know, you gave me a sneak preview of how many things you've been compiling here, which is why you're on the program. So I want to get out of your way and have you continue.
There's a few more juicy ones. These are all from February 23rd. USA Today's William Cummings published an article titled, They Like Bernie. Biden Says Russia Working to Prevent Him from Getting Nomination. Cummings writes that Biden's claims were, quote, not based on anything he'd been told by intelligence officials, end quote. So, I mean, the only way you can interpret that is Biden is just making things up. He's not basing it on any intelligence, so then he's just pulling it out of his head. So Dan Pfeiffer stated on NBC's Meet the Press that the Russians are, quote, not trying to help Bernie Sanders be president. They're trying to give Trump the opponent Trump wants. And then Rahm Emanuel said on ABC News program this week, referring to Sanders, that, quote, Putin and Trump are picking their opponent. This is not who we want on the ticket. And then a really, really misleading one is one that was put out by the Daily Beast on March 1st. A real hit piece here. Quote, Kremlin media still like Bernie because they love Trump. They argue that Bernie is Russia's favorite nominee because he's the most likely to lose to Trump. They also opine that Biden is the Kremlin's most feared candidate. Now, the thing that I find most incredulous is that the logic for these absurd arguments don't even add up. They are the opposite of the truth. You know, national as well as battleground state polls repeatedly show that Bernie is the most likely nominee to beat Trump. In fact, he's the only one that consistently beats Trump. Sanders beats Trump in 68 of 73 national polls. Polls taken back in 2016 also showed that Bernie was the stronger candidate against Trump. Trump himself has admitted that he didn't want Clinton to pick Sanders as her running mate in 2016. So are we supposed to believe that the Russians are stupid? Or that they don't read the polls? That they aren't aware of basic publicly available information that demonstrates Sanders as the strongest candidate against Trump? The logic would say that if the Russians were truly involved in subverting this election in Trump's favor, then they certainly wouldn't be backing Sanders. They would be backing Biden. I think the most important question to ask from all this is, why do the corporate media misinform the public and treat them like idiots? And I want to mention Tulsi Gabbard. She wrote a piece in The Hill in which she rightfully accuses U.S. intelligence agencies rather than the Russians of election interference. And I'd like to read what she wrote. She says, it is now clear that the mainstream corporate media and the warmongering political establishment are seeking to do two things. Create enough suspicion around Sanders by falsely tarnishing him as a puppet of Russia that he loses the election. Or two, at the very least, if Bernie wins the Democratic nomination, force him to engage in inflammatory anti-Russian rhetoric and perpetuate the new Cold War and nuclear arms race, which are existential threats to our country and the world. That's how I see it. It's not Russian interference. It's intelligence agencies who are interfering with the electoral process in the United States.
This is your take on what you're seeing here go on with, I can't say reprise of Russiagate. It's always kind of been either in the forefront or just in the background. And it's in terms of in media studies, pre-mediation, the constant priming of something that's yet to unfold. Russiagate is from the 2016 election onward. In fact, we can go back to the Ukraine. We can go back to the Obama administration, you know, when there were clear choices made to really ramp up more NATO efforts against Russia. It's almost like the Cold War hasn't ended. It paused and now we're back here, and it has this neo-McCarthyite effect of tarnishing and smearing people here. So I'd like to remind listeners, by the way, that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Emil Marmel. We're talking about the ongoing phenomenon of Russiagate as it's being used politically, domestically, inside the United States and within the Democratic primary. Emil Marmel is a media scholar and author. He contributed to Censored 2020. He co-authored a chapter called Fake News, the Trojan Horse for Silencing Alternative News and Reestablishing Corporate News Dominance. We'll continue our conversation with Emil Marmel after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
Paranoia strikes deep. Into your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, in this segment, we are talking about the ongoing saga of Russiagate and the Russians are coming in the context of the Democratic primary. I'm speaking with media scholar Emil Marmel. He is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, Ontario Institute for Studies and Education. Emil also is co-author with Lee Major of a chapter in our last book, Censored 2020, Through the Looking Glass. The chapter was called Fake News, the Trojan Horse for Silencing Alternative News and Reestablishing Corporate News Dominance. Emil Marmel was on the program last year talking about that chapter for anybody that wants to go back in the archives and listen to it at projectcensored.org. But today, we've got Emil Marmel back because he's recently been writing about the use of Russiagate in a neo-McCarthyite way to smear candidates inside the Democratic primary. So, Emil Marmel, let's continue. Does anybody believe Russiagate anymore?
I'd like to think I'm friends with lots of intelligent people. But you don't have to be stupid to be misled or to believe what the corporate media tells you. But I decided to look up some polls to see, you know, what is the pulse? Because I think, how could you possibly still believe this nonsense? And what I found that is that on the one hand, several polls reveal that Americans are tired of the focus on Russiagate and that there are many more pressing and important things for the government to focus on. So in a sense, people want to move on. Nevertheless, an Ipsos Reuters poll taken in March of 2019 after the Mueller investigation concluded that there was no collusion between Trump and the Russians showed that 48% of Americans still believed that that Trump or someone from his campaign worked with Russia to influence the 2016 election. Now, what's important to note is that this belief was split strongly along party lines, with 84% of Democrats believing there was collusion and only 17% of Republicans agreeing with it. So what this tells us is that among Democrats, who are Russiagate's target market, that the Russiagate conspiracy still carries much influence. So Russiagate smears, in fact, are still a very effective propaganda strategy used to influence Democratic voters.
We'd have to assume that, right, Emil Marmel, because they keep using it, they keep going to it. So it's working with somebody, and it's working with a big base of moderate Democrats, would you say?
I completely agree with that.
Well, like I said, when we started this conversation, Emil, there are a lot of folks, I think, well-educated people, people that, you know, we've worked with for a long time. Through the project or colleagues on campus, they're really worried about the Russian influence. And look, this isn't to say that there is no meddling or there isn't some issue involving this. Other countries from China to Israel and Turkey, they all have an interest in the U.S. election. The U.S., of course, has meddled in scores of elections over the
of
last
course.
Several decades, including in Russia with Yeltsin and the Clinton
yes.
years. So it's not like we're
Absolutely.
Discounting this. Our focus today is on how this is being resurrected as a form of propaganda. I've been mentioning neo-McCarthyism for a while. I'm kind of shocked when people say this has nothing to do with neo-McCarthyism. That's not a good analogy. I think it's a pretty great analogy historically. I mean, meaning an accurate one.
McCarthyism was used to shut down opposing dissenting voices. I mean, what's the difference between what's happening now and what happened back then? It's being used in the exact same way. Shut down and discredit anything that goes against the status quo of the system as it currently exists.
Russiagate isn't just being used against Sanders. It was used against Gabbard. It was used prior to that against Jill Stein and the Green Party. We're witnessing the entire corporate Democratic establishment, corporate media, yeah. Political economic elites, they're coalescing against Sanders. But you know, I think you have more to say.
It's used against essentially anybody who steps out of line. And I did want to talk about what's going on in this nomination process in addition to Russiagate, because it isn't simply Russiagate that's being used against Sanders. And what we're seeing, what we're witnessing, is the entire corporate Democratic establishment apparatus, the corporate media and political and economic elites coalescing against Sanders. Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar both dropped out of the race right before Super Tuesday and both endorsed Biden, Bernie's only serious opponent. They both probably have their eyes on cabinet positions in the event Biden wins the White House. And by the way, there are reports now circulating that Obama helped to encourage both Buttigieg and Klobuchar to endorse Biden. And then you've got even Beto O'Rourke, who I'd forgotten about that guy. He came out of the woodwork to endorse Biden. And then you have Elizabeth Warren, who didn't stand a chance at winning the nomination, refusing to bow out until the morning of March 5th, after the Super Tuesday damage had already been done. Warren's supporters will now hopefully overwhelmingly flock to Sanders. And I think it'll be really interesting to see who she endorses, if anyone, because, you know, Warren's strategy has been to wait it out, and it might still be, until the convention in Milwaukee as, quote, the final play, as was stated by her campaign. And I found this interesting article by Ruth Oskolkoff. She reported on January 28th that, according to a reliable source, quote, high-level party members and associates of the Democratic National Committee said that they have now selected Biden as the Democratic Party nominee, with Warren as the VP. They also said the plan is to smear Bernie as a Russian asset. So, you know, I don't know if that's a lucky guess, but much of it has in fact come to pass, as we're seeing. So I don't doubt that source, the accuracy of that source. And then, you know, you've got Bloomberg, and his strategy has always been to prevent Sanders from attaining a majority of the delegates, with the hopes that someone else other than Bernie will win the nomination at a brokered national convention, most likely Biden or perhaps, you know, Warren.
Warren yep. also dropped out, and Bloomberg's dropped out. But again, we're still seeing that pushback. It seems like all of these folks are coalescing around an anti-Sanders nomination.
Anything can happen at a brokered convention. They could pick out anybody out of a hat and say, you're the person. As long as no single person get over 50% of the delegates, they can do whatever they want according to their undemocratic rules.
That's an ironic phrase, but I understand Democratic Party rules, yes.
And Bloomberg has also endorsed Biden. And as we're speaking, the superdelegates are on the record saying that if Bernie doesn't arrive at the convention with over 50% of the pledged delegates, that they're going to give the nomination to somebody else. So even if Sanders has the plurality of the delegates, they are saying that they will choose someone else over the will of the voters. So in sum, what you have is all these very powerful establishment figures working strategically to prevent Sanders from winning the nomination. The thing that gets me is even Trump, our stable genius in chief, can see what's happening. He tweeted on March 4th, quote, the Democratic establishment came together and crushed Bernie Sanders again. Even the fact that Elizabeth Warren stayed in the race was devastating to Bernie and allowed Sleepy Joe to unthinkably win Massachusetts. It was a perfect storm with many good states remaining for Joe. So even Trump is acknowledging things that many people who consider themselves progressive are refusing to see.
Well, in fact, Emil Marmel, Nolan Higdon, and I wrote about the corporate media. They went from ignoring Bernie to bashing Bernie. It was like the Bernie blackout to bashing Bernie. Elizabeth Warren saw some of the same coming in. She was sort of a darling early on in the media in a lot of ways. But then things really turned, and the media really started to ignore her, too. Now, of course, since she's dropped out, let's actually go back and talk a little bit more about this isn't just the DNC and insider Democrats and others against the Sanders movement. Corporate media has clearly been against that. We remember Chris Matthews was finally shown the door or walked himself out at MSNBC. He was comparing the victory that Sanders had in the first three primaries, the historic victory, by the way, to France falling to the Nazis. I mean, this kind of hyperbolic, ahistorical nonsense that passes for commentary and news is just beyond absurd. But so I do hope the door hits Matthews on the way out. But nevertheless, why don't you tell us a little bit more about this trend on the corporate media being against Sanders?
It's unmistakable and it's vicious. You know, the same way they did in 2016, the corporate news media are doing everything they can to stop Bernie. For instance, even in the states that he won early on, the media focused on who came in second, third, or fourth while diminishing Sanders' performance. The same has been true of polls. Even when Sanders leads in the polls, the focus turns to how well the other nominees are doing. And the corporate media have been absolutely apoplectic in their disdain of Bernie. A study published by In These Times and written by Jacobin's Branko Marchetic demonstrates conclusively that MSNBC has a clear bias against Sanders. The corporate media mentions Sanders less than Biden and Warren, and when he's mentioned, he is the most likely to be mentioned negatively. You can also read numerous excellent articles on FAIR. I mean, FAIR is doing a great job discussing these points.
And NPR's coverage has just been deplorable. They've ignored him outright, and now they've taken to bashing him as well. NPR has been just as bad in some ways, I would say, as MSNBC. And Matthews, of course, is an example of that. But CNN, Michael Smirkanish, not long ago compared Sanders and his campaign to the coronavirus.
It's such an irresponsible thing to do. Whenever you compare a person or a group of people to a virus or an infestation, especially someone who belongs to a group that was exterminated in massive numbers, it's an irresponsible thing to do.
Indeed. And well, Chuck Todd, Jason Johnson, I mean, there's so many others. Tell us a little bit about some of these other examples.
So as you mentioned, Chris Matthews compared Sanders' win to Hitler's invasion of France. Matthews has also suggested that if the Reds had won the Cold War, Sanders might have been found cheering on hypothetical executions in Central Park. And then, as you said, you got Smirkanish comparing him to the coronavirus. NBC News anchor Chuck Todd cited a quote in support of a conservative columnist that compared Sanders supporters to, quote, a digital brown shirt brigade. And for those who don't know, a brown shirt is a Nazi or a fascist. Jason Johnson, a regular contributor at MSNBC, referred to Sanders' black women supporters as those who come from the island of misfit black girls. He has also said that, quote, racist liberal whites seem to love them some Bernie Sanders consistently. And this is total nonsense. And another thing the media often does is equate Bernie with Trump in one way or another. MSNBC anchor Nicole Wallace said that they both employ, quote, dark arts of abusing the press, of bullying the press. She referred to Bernie's followers as a squeaky, angry minority. And I think we all know that Sanders supporters are not a minority. You know, we're angry at the status quo, and justifiably so. The thing that I find so contradictory is that the corporate media simultaneously paint him as both a Stalinist communist and as a Nazi fascist, when in reality, we all know he's just a moderate reformer. He's more similar to FDR than an actual socialist. And they're simply throwing the most vitriolic, emotion-eliciting epithets at him in the hopes of destroying him, even if the terms they use to describe him, like communist and fascist, are diametrically opposed.
That's one of the more riveting things that we've seen, is just the absolute ahistorical or revisionist historical making up definitions as they go along from one extreme to another to tarnish this particular candidate. I see Bernie Sanders much more as sort of a Franklin Roosevelt type, the Four Freedoms, a New Dealer. Again, if people think that's radical, I guess you got to go back 90 years to take a solid look at this. But at any rate, that's where we are. That's how much the baseline is shifted to the right. This did happen in the 30s. You know, a lot of the corporate types and the corporate heads that tried to get Smedley Butler to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt and the coup in 34 that didn't happen, they all saw him as this horrible communist, socialist. This has been in the playbook, and this is, again, something that we saw in the Cold War with McCarthy. And again, here we are dealing with it yet again.
You're the historian, so tell me if I'm wrong, but FDR made those changes because the United States was in such tumult at the time that, you know, the ruling class were afraid there was going to be actual civil unrest, like tumult, like they would be taken out of power. And so it wasn't so much out of FDR's heart. He did it to keep peace in the nation. There was a businessman who tried to, I think, hire a general
Yeah, that would be Smedley Butler.
Really?
Yeah, it was Smedley Butler. It's a 1934 failed coup plot. But Emil Marmol, in the last couple of minutes we have left, why don't we talk about where there really is some foreign interference or at least influence peddling, and then we'll have to wrap up the segment. But where have you seen some actual foreign interference that's of note, particularly in the Democratic primary?
Right. Well, I mean, look, recently Israel's ambassador to the UN called Bernie a liar, an ignorant fool, or both. Those are very strong words against a politician in the United States who's hoping to become president. Then you've got, and this is a little bit older, but it pertains to Bernie, you've got war criminal and previous prime minister of the UK, Tony Blair, who chimed in 2016 to warn Democratic voters not to support Bernie Sanders. I mean, if that isn't foreign election interference, I don't know what is. And then you've also got the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, has been funding a super PAC that is putting out attack ads against Bernie. So in Nevada alone, the super PAC, Democratic Majority for Israel, spent a staggering $1.4 million on attack ads against Sanders in that state alone. How does that not constitute foreign meddling? And, you know, one that has just occurred to me, not related to Bernie, but it's, you know, I was shocked when I saw it happen, was, as you know, I live in Canada now, and last year Obama publicly endorsed Justin Trudeau for prime minister. How does Obama's endorsement not constitute election meddling by a foreign power? Could you imagine what would happen if Putin publicly endorsed a candidate in the U.S., any candidate? There would be absolute bedlam.
You're right about how we would react culturally. And again, we've got a lot of double standards going back historically. We mentioned the Clinton administration before and their meddling in the Yeltsin election there. But at any rate, there's a lot for us to chew on here and a lot to think about. And just because we're talking about this from a media studies perspective, a critical media literacy perspective, and we're using that lens, you know, this doesn't mean that we're here endorsing the Sanders campaign per se. This program isn't taking a candidate or picking a candidate here. We're just pointing out, however, that there is, at least to us, an obvious attempt to attack, at least in the two corporate parties. Sanders is the most progressive or left-leaning of the Democrats that's left running, and there's been a pretty much full court press against him, and it continues, and we'll likely continue to see it through the primaries into the summer. And Emil Marmol, let's have you back on in the future here sometime this spring to get us an update. Emil Marmol, thank you so much for taking time
to
join us on the program. Again, yes, we'll have you back, Emil.
Thank you, Mickey. Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About a criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons fill the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fiend at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love. Can't